This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and develop your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. In this episode, we talk with aviation journalist Jason Rabinowitz about the recent Delta Media Day, the Aircraft Interiors Expo, flying a China Eastern 777, and the Route Happy service. In the news, we discuss the Delta order for CS-100 aircraft, Boeing increasing their spare parts business, American Airlines earnings, and ATC privatization. All that and what Boeing needs to do to make the 737 better, coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 399 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Rob Mark. He's an aviation journalist, a pilot, a flight instructor, and publisher of the Jetwine blog from Chicago. Hey, Rob.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. Good evening to everybody everywhere. Welcome to episode 399.
Hard to believe. Also joining us is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Brian, just back from what, Germany?
Yeah, back from Germany, did a quick trip, was out there on Monday and back on Friday. So when I say a quick trip, I mean it.
That is a quick trip. You also attended an interesting air show.
I did. I was at the Planes of Fame air show in Chino, California, just a little bit to the east of me here, and had a fantastic time out there. And I need to apologize. There are three or four listeners that sent me emails trying to get a hold of me, and somehow on my phone, my Airplane Geeks email account got deleted, and I never got their emails till I got back home and turned on my computer. So I apologize tremendously to the folks that tried to get in touch with me out there.
Damn technology.
Yep.
All right. Well, we've got a interview that you recorded at that show coming up in a little bit that I think is very interesting. Looking forward to that. We've also got with us Max Trescott, the other Max on the show. He's a certified flight instructor, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Max, how are you?
Wow, $3.99. I'm tired just thinking about that.
Yes.
that's a lot of shows times an hour and a half or two and so on and so forth. I'm feeling slightly tired, and I realized I would be feeling a lot more tired if I had been up at 5 a.m. this morning to watch the Solar Impulse leave. It's on its way to Phoenix, and I'm happy to say I was snoozing away when it left.
That's right. Well, good. I'm glad to hear that you're getting a little bit of rest. It's always
exactly
good. Our favorite aviation historian, David Vanderhoof, is off this episode, had some family come to visit, so he's taking care of that business, as he should. We'll have him back for episode 400 next week. Well, let's introduce our guest for this episode, a returning guest, actually. It's aviation journalist Jason Rabinowitz. Jason's a contributing writer for Mary Kirby's Runway Girl Network. He's a correspondent for airlinereporter.com. He writes for Forbes. He also researches the passenger experience as the data research manager over at Route Happy. Jason, welcome back to the show. Did I get everything in there?
I think you did. Yeah, there's a couple other sites here or there, but that's the good bulk of it. But thanks so much for having me. I'm just looking back at my show history, and my first show was episode 286. Feels like an eternity, but it's $3.99. Congrats on the upcoming 400.
Yeah, thank you. We're really pleased to have you here. I think we've got some topics that are going to be of interest to us and to all of you listening, but we'll start with a little bit of aviation news from the past week. So is everybody ready?
Ready.
Yeah. Ready.
Ready from the West.
We'll start off the news with a little bit of Bombardier C-Series. items. As we mentioned last week, we were anticipating an order from Delta, and they did come through. They ordered 75 firm, 50 option CS-100 aircraft. That, of course, gives that program a boost that they really needed. Deliveries are scheduled to start in spring of 2018. Interestingly, Delta has conversion rights to the CS-300, so they might swap for the larger aircraft. There's a quote in the Aviation Week article from Bombardier President and CEO Alain Bellemare. He said, "The addition of Delta to our marquee C-Series customer list gives us tremendous momentum as we approach entry into service this summer." So I think that's a fair statement. I think it was not a surprise that Delta was going to come through with this, and that Bombardier was going to have this nice order from a sort of A-list kind of customer. And it sort of sends a message to others, perhaps, who might be thinking about the C-Series.
Christmas in April. I mean, yes. They've got to be incredibly excited up there.
I was going to say, when I heard you use the phrase incredible momentum, oh, yeah, right. They're probably going, yay, thank God. Oh, my God, our jobs are safe. Oh, jeez.
When I was down in Atlanta at Delta Media Day this past week, the Bombardier representatives that were on board with this aircraft, I've never seen anyone from that company that happy as I did last week.
Oh, no doubt. I think it's kind of a morale booster, I would suspect.
Kind of.
This is huge for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how many times, Jason, did you guys figure the C-Series was on its last legs?
I mean, I can't even tally up the number of times, at least on my head or on Twitter, I said, well, Bombardier, I don't know about them. They don't look too long for this world, but the last couple of weeks and months, really, after that, after the rumors came out that Delta was going to order it, it's been a huge boost for this program. And who knows, maybe they will stick around.
Now, wouldn't you love to know what they paid for the airplanes?
I don't think they're going to want to be too public about what price Delta paid.
Well, that's actually a very interesting question. There's an article over at Leeham News, which we were introduced to last episode with our guest, that notes that Bombardier has taken a second quarter 2016 charge of $500 million, which is about $4 million per aircraft. And that comes from a Bombardier press release. And Liam News concludes that means the aircraft were sold at a loss, but that they kind of needed to in order to have Delta on the customer list. But, this is sort of the way that this industry often works, where the selling price, the asking price, and the actual price paid can be widely different and not always related to the cost to actually manufacture the airplane or the engine or whatever.
I was just looking at the quantities. They only had 250 orders prior to this order coming in, so 90 new orders. That's a 36% increase in volume. So that makes a huge difference in terms of at least reducing, cutting your losses somewhat.
And Delta's really playing the C-Series up as what seemingly is going to be the premier narrow-body aircraft in their fleet. Ed Bastian was really touting the customer experience, the in-flight entertainment system they're going to put on, how wide the seats are. They were really touting it as the best thing coming to their fleet.
Jason, do you really think that it'll be a competitor to the Boeing 737-700?
From a customer experience standpoint, it is vastly superior than the 737. The seats are wider, the windows are bigger, you can get better seat pitch, you can get more comfortable seats, the bins are bigger, the laboratories are better. Everything about it is really better from a passenger standpoint than the 737. There's only so much you can do with the fuselage width on that aircraft. And Bombardier came out with a clean sheet design that actually seems to have the passenger's comfort in mind.
Are there any trade-offs? I mean, is the overall, the range worse or gas mileage or what? Where does the 737 still excel compared to this?
you don't see all that many orders for the 700 or the Mac 7 coming up. So really, from my point of view, the C series seems like the perfect kind of fit for Delta. We did see United place a very seemingly very cheap order for the 700 current series, not the Max Neo, the Mac 7, but there aren't all that many orders out there for the Mac 7.
Yeah, and that's very true. And yeah, we've talked a little bit about that and how Boeing may be making some adjustments to the lineup there to respond to some of these market realities that they're discovering as the 737 MAX progresses along here. But speaking of Boeing, and again, kind of going back to that issue of how companies make money in this industry, John Ostrower wrote an interesting article, Boeing Boosts Push into Plane Parts Arena. And if you think about the revenue streams that an airframer can benefit from in this industry, there's selling airplanes. That's one, right? But sometimes that's negative revenue. I know that we see that in other areas too, sometimes with engine suppliers. You know, every time you sell an engine, you can actually damage your profits for the year. So that creates kind of some odd behaviors. But selling planes is one. Selling spare parts or replacement parts, that's another revenue stream. Providing maintenance services or selling other services, all those are potential revenue streams. And often what we find is the positive long-term revenue streams offset the short-term negative or very small streams. Now, Boeing is looking to grow the spares revenue stream, and what they've actually done is pulled back licensing agreements with some of their suppliers. So, for example, in the past, airlines could purchase parts directly from Spirit AeroSystems, right? Spirit's a very large supplier to Boeing. And if you're a Boeing customer and you need certain types of spare parts, replacement parts, you could go to Spirit AeroSystems to buy them. Well, now the parts are going to be sold from Boeing, or at least some of them are. Spirit will still manufacture them, but Boeing will sell them. And that will, I think, adjust the kind of the relative margins of those companies. So it's an interesting move on Boeing's part to try to kind of vertically integrate through the supply side for their customers.
Yeah, Boeing's doing a lot of interesting things recently. John Ostrower also mentioned that Wall Street Journal article that Boeing is going to be offering supplier furnished seats for the 737 for the first time ever in that program's history, which means historically in the past, an airline would order a 737 and they would supply their own seats from the seat manufacturer, whether it's BE Aerospace or Recaro, and they would be responsible for getting those seats to the production line to get them on the aircraft. But what Boeing announced is they're going to have basically the stock seat that you can just, when you order a 737, an airline could just check a box saying, I want the house Boeing seat. And they will just install it. They'll take care of everything. They'll take care of the production line, the supply chain, and they'll get it done for you. And that's something Boeing has not done in the history of the 737 program. So they're making a lot of interesting changes like this.
And that sounds attractive to the airlines if they don't have to shop around quite so much. As long as Boeing is selling the type of product that they want at the price point that they're looking for, so Boeing has to obviously keep that in mind. But interesting to see. Yeah, it's about margins and developing the cash flow that funds these activities like the development of new aircraft. Other areas, I mentioned jet engine, the side of this industry, did this kind of a long time ago where you go back far enough and the profits were made not so much from selling the engines, but selling the spare parts. That's where the major revenue stream was. Sell engine at a loss and you've got 20 years or 30 years of spare parts stream coming in to fund the whole thing. That situation changed somewhat, and that's why you saw some engine manufacturers and others get more into the maintenance side of the business so they could generate the revenues they needed. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic to this industry and one that's changing, and we're seeing changes now hit Boeing.
maybe they can take some of this extra profit they're making from spare parts and put it into revigorating the 757 line, maybe retool that a bit.
Yeah, the 757 replacement. Well, you know, we read about that in the news. People talk about the need for, you know, a plane in that size segment of the market. Boeing is out there developing the 737 MAX, the 777X, the tanker. All these things cost money. You need cash flow to support that. Maybe in part this move in spares is to help fund that. But speaking of seating in 737s, who came up with this next story? Was that you, Brian?
Yeah, the one about taking the engine cowling and turning it into a chair.
That's right.
I thought you would appreciate that.
This is from Wired. The title of the article is, "Come on, you know you want a chair made out of a 737 engine." Well, the chair's not really made out of an engine. It's made out of a nacelle. This is a fallen furniture. They take objects that are not furniture and they turn them into furniture. So what we have here is the cowling chair. Started out as a Boeing 737 engine cowling. According to this article, they bought it for £5,000, which is around $7,300 U.S., and they turned it into a chair and sold it for £19,000, or about $28,000. So, you know, it's a big chair. I mean, the engine cowling for a CFM56 is no small little thing. You've got to have a big room for this big chair.
Yeah, it looks comfy though.
I think the chair is bigger than my entire office.
I think. Yeah. They also have some interesting things. I don't know if you surfed around their website, but I also see they have an 8-foot-tall practice cluster bomb that they've turned into a drink cabinet. And they also have a table that they've made out of a 747 wheel and tire. So this is kind of high-end stuff. Rob, if you have any ideas about, outfitting the office with some of this really interesting aviation-based furniture, and if you have to ask how much it costs, then you can't afford it.
Sorry, but you lost me at cluster bomb.
Interesting. So check that out. We'll have a link to Fallen Furniture in the show notes. Even if you're not interested in forking over potentially tens of thousands of dollars for truly unique furniture, it's kind of interesting stuff to look at.
Everyone needs one.
Yeah, everyone needs one. We had a couple other items come in late. I think Max Trescott, I think you're responsible for these. What are we looking at here?
Oh, you know, Wall Street always has something to say, and apparently American Airlines was in the news this last week earning $700 million, but people aren't happy enough about that. So, you know, things are getting a little soft, and revenue looks like it might get even softer as summer rolls around here. So it doesn't sound like some of these airline stocks are good buys right now. you would think that, cheaper fuel would have helped, but what they're saying is that may have actually masked the fact that average ticket prices were slowly trending down. So, I don't know. What do you think about it?
I think investing in airline stocks is always a risky business. Although, you know, lately, yeah, with all of the, with the low price of fuel, with the just vast revenues coming in from fees of various sorts, it has looked pretty good. But I think we are seeing some revenue drop off. I think for American, there was a drop off first quarter, 7.5% from the year prior. And, that's a big deal. That's something that Wall Street looks at and kind of gulps at.
Oh, yeah. They'll be talking about give backs for the employees pretty soon, I'm sure.
Yeah. No doubt, right? And then we also have an item, air traffic control plan faces tough fight ahead. This is from thehill.com. Max T., what are we seeing here?
Well, we're showing that the Transportation Committee in the House is still going to be pushing really hard to try and privatize ATC. There was a lot of celebration back in the February, March timeframe. People thought, oh, wow, we beat that back. We won. And I was one of the folks who cautioned, this is temporary. These guys will be coming back and trying to continue to push this. Interestingly, the this article on the Hill basically says that the plan to privatize ATC is going to face some tough sledding ahead. Now, 5 days ago, the Wall Street Journal had an article that was just glowing about how wonderful it is. We have to privatize. Oh my gosh, the Canadians have such a wonderful system. Boy, we need to be just like them. So that's consistent with what Wall Street Journal has been saying, you know, throughout this entire cycle of the push toward privatization. And Representative Bill Schuster, who is the gentleman from Pennsylvania who's been pushing this, narrowly won his primary. He beat the challenger 52-48 a week or so ago in the Pennsylvania primary. So that means he's still in the driver's seat and he can still try and push this forward. So I think for general aviation, most of us agree this is probably a really bad thing for small aircraft because it looks like the airlines are going to try and push the cost of ATC off of their backs and onto the backs of the people that can at least afford to pay it.
And time is kind of running out, right? The with the extension, the FAA funding, I think, expires July 15th now. We have the House has 3 weeks recess before then. So, you know, there's kind of not so much time to make some movement on this in terms of bringing ATC privatization back in. But like you say, Schuster is he's just bent on making this happen. So we'll have to continue to watch this very carefully.
That's the part that frightens me most about this, is that I think he's hell-bent on winning, and I don't know that it really makes that much sense economically, but I don't think he cares.
Yeah, you mean he's more interested in the win than the reason for the win?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think he's decided that now that he's back in the seat, you know, he was worried there for a little bit that he wasn't going to get reelected, and now all bets are off, and I'm right back where I want, you know, to get this thing going. It'd be curious to see if the Air Traffic Controllers Union is still solidly behind this like they were a few months ago. I haven't heard anything from them.
Yeah, you would think with all the opposition in the Senate and even in the House from both sides, really, that you would think that you should just back off on this until someone can. So if you really want it to happen, I think the best advice would be to back off on it now and then, you know, go back and develop a strategy. But just to keep pushing it now, it just seems like, you know, pushing a rope uphill.
Well, the Senate bill has no privatization in it. So hopefully when the reauthorization, gets resolved in the House committee, in the conference committee between the House and the Senate bills, privatization won't be in there. But even if we win this round, we know it's going to rear its ugly head again probably in 2017. So this is just going to be a continuing battle. These, the folks that are trying to do this just seem relentless in their desire to make it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the call to action, still go out and let your congressperson know how you feel about this.
Yeah, and that best advice that I've heard is what we relayed a couple of episodes ago about how members of the Congress are returning home during their break and a lot of them having public forums listen to their constituents, and that's a great time to stand up, walk up to the mic, and state your opinions on this, and give some reasons why you're, well, if you're for it, you might be, but otherwise, reasons why this is a bad idea, why you think this is something that should not happen. So, take advantage of your rights to speak up. All right, we're speaking again with Jason Rabinowitz. Jason, you mentioned that you were at Delta Media Day. Can you kind of give us an idea of what a media day is like with Delta?
Yeah, so this is the first one I had been to with Delta, and it's basically the airline invites a bunch of members of the media down to corporate headquarters down in Atlanta. And you, at some point, you have interviews with the CEO, top executives, and at this particular media day, it was also media day and fleet showcase. So we went on down to Delta Tech Ops alongside one of the runways at ATL, and they put all their new and refurbished aircraft out on the flight line. They had one of the first Delta Airbus A321. They had a Boeing 737-900, both fresh from the factory. 757, an A330, an MD. No, I'm sorry, it was a 717, the CRJ-700, and it was basically, here's our newly refurbished and brand new aircraft. Go poke around, see what you like, and ask us some questions about it. And it was also a great time to talk to the new CEO of Delta, Ed Bastian, who was actually just inducted today.
Oh, how is? Did he give a presentation?
Yeah, we actually had about an hour and a half interview with him. It was a group of about 30 to maybe 40 members of the media just tossing any random question out to the CEO of this major global airline. And we actually went quite a bit over our allotted time, but he answered pretty much any question we threw out him, from premium economy to the open skies debate to everything in between. And it was a really great opportunity to get some insight into the inner workings of Delta, what their plans for the future are, and how they're adapting to the ever-changing climate that is the aviation industry.
So did he come across as somebody that was able to hit the ground running, as opposed to someone who's going to have to take a few months to kind of get up to speed and that sort of thing?
No, he's definitely going to hit the ground sprinting. He's not new to Delta. He's been Richard Anderson's right-hand man for a long time. He's been with Delta for a very long time. And if there's anyone to take the reins of that major airline, it's him. He knows his stuff. He's very, very well-spoken. And so far, I mean, it's day one and nothing's gone wrong yet. So that's good.
You mentioned Delta Tech Ops. Are they still doing a lot of third-party overhaul and repair work? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, it's a fairly large MRO, maintenance repair operation they have down at Atlanta. And it's funny you mentioned that they have some third-party aircraft. That was basically the one rule we had during that was we were told there's going to be an aircraft in one of the hangars. It does not belong to Delta, and you were not to take pictures of it or acknowledge its existence. Mm. But just between you and me and the listeners, it may have been a slightly presidential aircraft.
Ah, interesting. Interesting.
I'll say no more.
All right. We don't want to get you in trouble. going back to the revenue streams, I think that in years past, more of the larger airlines with their own engineering departments did a lot of their own repair work in that sort of thing. And Delta was an example of a company that kind of took that base and said, well, you know what, we can actually generate some revenue, or at least help cover some of our costs by bringing in work from others and doing the work there. And I think Delta Tech Ops developed a pretty good reputation for the work that they did.
Yeah, Tech Ops definitely has a very, very good reputation. Airlines from all over the world will fly their aircraft to Atlanta or their facility. I actually passed one in Tokyo, Narita. So they're fairly global, and major airlines, even competitors to Delta, will bring their aircraft to Atlanta or wherever Tech Ops is for cabin refurbishment or engine swaps or C or D checks. They do pretty much everything.
Yeah, good. Now, you were also at the Aircraft Interiors Expo in Hamburg earlier this month. I know I've talked to Mary Kirby a little bit about that, but what were your observations from that show?
So yeah, AIX, the Aircraft Interior Expo, is the absolute culmination of everything that is the passenger experience. It's once a year in Hamburg, every year, and it's where everyone from airlines to manufacturers to airframers, they all show off their latest and greatest of what's going to be the future of the passenger experience. I mean, we're talking everything from seats to IFE systems to connectivity systems to the little actuators in the seat that make the lie-flat seat actually go lie-flat, and fasteners. And it's really just quite massive. The show is huge at this point. Every year I maybe see 10% of the show. And if you want to get a look at what you're going to be flying in 2 to maybe 5 years, that's where you go. Everything goes through that show at some point or another.
What's going on with seating these days? How about Zodiac? I know that there was an FAA AD for Zodiac seats. Anything new on that you're aware of?
Yeah, so Zodiac's not doing too hot these days. They've had some pretty major delays delivering products. American actually voided their contract for their business class seats with Zodiac. One of their facilities in Washington State pretty much exploded. And then last week or the week before, there was this airworthiness directive from the FAA that certain seats that were installed on mainly regional jets and the 717 MD-90 series had a safety flaw. And airlines that have this seat are going to have to, at some point in the upcoming years, have to modify these seats so they're not, unfortunately, a danger to the public. And then if an incident were to arise on a flight.
Man, that's got to be incredibly expensive to affect that kind of a repair.
Yeah, the FAA kind of lowballed the number a bit. They gave a very low, suspicious number, like maybe that's the cost for actually swapping out the seat and putting new hardware on board. But that doesn't account for taking the plane out of service for a few days or a week at a time and the lost revenue from not having your full fleet. And yeah, seats, taking an aircraft out of service for an extended period of time because of an issue with seats. That adds up quickly.
Yeah, I would think that would be much, much greater than the cost of actually physically repairing or replacing the seats.
Yeah, I mean, when you add up the cost of the seats, it's probably chump change in comparison to having to take out large portions of your fleet. This is a large portion of certain fleets. I mean, we're talking about CRJ-700s, 717s. So these aren't rare aircraft. These are aircraft that are flying hundreds of flights every day. Hmm.
Is it still true that the folks at Spirit and Allegiant are going to be going with the apple cart kind of seat in their airplanes, or is that
wooden box?
Just a rumor? Yeah, wooden boxes. Maybe they can get the seats from them.
Why have seats at all? Just stand.
Yeah. Well, you know, no. See, now didn't
O'Leary
have that idea?
O'Leary, yeah. Oh.
Yeah, and you know what? Seat designs are getting closer and closer to that. There is one seat on display at the Aircraft Interior Expo, which is based, I wouldn't call it a standing seat, but it's not a regular seat. It's kind of like a leaning seat. It's we're getting closer to the standing seat.
Great. I can't wait.
yeah, sorry to burst that bubble, but it's almost inevitable. Yeah.
I don't know, Jason, I was just in Germany and flew on a Lufthansa flight, and their seats, they must have been ultra, ultra slimline seats. I'd never seen anything so thin in my entire life.
The Lufthansa NEK Recaro seat is kind of referred to as the lawn chair of aircraft seating. It is super, super thin. It is not the most comfortable seat. And hopefully you are on a pretty short haul flight, because I would not want to be sitting in that for a long flight.
Yeah, it was me and a Hamburg, so it wasn't terrible, but sheesh.
Yeah, I recently flew Alaska from JFK to Seattle, and they use a variation of that seat. It's a Recaro seat. It's not quite as thin as the Lufthansa one, but that's a six-hour transcon flight, and the back is just like a wooden board. After hour three and four, it was not a good ride.
So, Jason, when you're at the Interiors Expo like this, is this kind of a conversation something that comes up? I mean, amongst us, you know, the traveling public, we talk about seating issues and complain about it all the time. But when you're in and amongst the manufacturers, the airlines buying this stuff, do they ever have this conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. A few years ago, we were in this position where there weren't all that many seating manufacturers. You chose between BE Aerospace or Recaro or Zodiac or whoever, but there weren't that many fresh, innovative ideas beyond the ultra-thin seat. But a big tone at the show this year was new seating manufacturers coming out from the woodwork and bringing actual innovation to economy. One of my favorite examples is the Acro seat, which you'll actually find right now on Spirit, Frontier, and I think even Allegiant. And although it's a slimline economy seat, it's actually really comfortable. They didn't design it just to be a slab of carbon fiber and maybe a little bit of padding, but it actually has some ergonomics built into it. And it's a seat I would actually seek out. I would look for that seat and fly it over one of these traditional slimline seats. So there was definitely, the message has been received loud and clear that passengers do not want to fly on a lawn chair. They want something more comfortable, and new firms are coming to the plate.
Yeah, that's encouraging. But it's also interesting that can we say that it's taking these new firms coming in to do this, that the old-time seat manufacturers, are they being slow to respond?
They have been slow to respond, but I think a few airlines have lit the fire under them this year. A major aircraft seat order was placed this year from AirAsia. Placed an order for hundreds of aircraft worth of seats from a manufacturer that's never sold seats before, Mirus Aircraft Seating. And AirAsia actually cooperatively designed the seat with Mirus, and they came in and bought tens of thousands of these seats right off the bat. And they were traditionally a BE Aerospace customer. And when BE loses hundreds of thousands of seat orders, they're going to take notice and they're going to make some changes.
Wow. I think over at the Runway Girl Network, John Walton, I think, wrote an article about the Aircraft Interiors Expo, talking about temperature control is the next business first-class frontier. What's that all about?
Yeah, so we were actually talking about this at the show. John's a good friend of mine, and I happened to wander past a smaller booth called Gentherm, I think, and it's actually a pretty innovative idea. I've been saying for a while that the last thing of the passenger experience in the premium cabin that I can't control is the temperature. Newer aircraft aren't being produced with overhead air vents, so whatever the flight attendants have set the temperature to, that's it. You just have to deal with it. So what they're actually doing with these new high-end business class and first class seats is embedding heating and cooling elements right into the seat. You might see that on some higher-end cars right now where you push a button and it diverts some of the air conditioning system right into the seat, and it actually works, and it's great. I'm really looking forward to seeing that. Probably won't see it in the back of the plane, though.
So this means the seat itself is heating up or cooling down, and you don't mean warmer or cooler air is coming out of the seat, or how does that work?
So there's actually a little fan and a heating and a heat sink inside the cushioning of the seat, basically, and it takes air. It either heats it or cools it and kind of blows the air out through little tiny holes in the seat's cushioning and the seat in the seat fabric. And you don't see it. It's just there. It's a button you press like you would to recline your seat. And magically, the temperature of the physical seat either goes up or down.
Fascinating.
Yeah, as much as I love the idea, to me, it sounds like a potential fire hazard. So I'm not sure if I like this.
Yeah, fire hazards are kind of, pardon my pun, but a hot button topic in premium cabins right now. It's lithium ion batteries are becoming so common in everything we use. And there was a big problem with a particular Air France seat where passengers would actually drop their phone or their iPad into a kind of a crevice in the seat, and they wouldn't realize it. They would go to recline their seat, and the seat would actually crush the phone. The phone, the lithium ion batteries would, I'm sure you've seen these videos before, they explode.
Yeah.
And when lithium ion batteries go, they're a problem. So
lithium plus oxygen is fire. So you don't want to break that seal at all.
Yeah, in a contained environment like an aircraft, the lithium ion fire is not really what you want. So maybe they want to forego the heating part and just do the cooling, and I'd be okay with that.
Any other observations from the Aircraft Interiors Expo?
So it's a bit interesting in that nothing was all that revolutionary. What we saw this year was pretty much everything that's been promised over the past couple of years is finally being delivered now. All the things that everyone said, it's going to be great and 2 to 5 years, you just wait and see. That's actually what's happening now. Or things like super high-speed internet in the sky on a global basis is actually happening right now. So when you pay your $10 or $30 or whatever dollars for Wi-Fi, you're actually going to be able to use it, unlike you are now, where it's kind of you can do your email, but don't bother trying to stream YouTube because we're going to block that. So we've actually gotten to the point where you can do whatever you want with your Wi-Fi in the sky. So one thing particularly interesting was the seat from Talos, who is traditionally an entertainment manufacturer. They don't really dabble in seats too much. But they had this concept where it was, a 21.3-inch entertainment screen built into the seat.
What?
And this, this made some pretty big headlines. 21.3 inches is actually wider than any economy seat in the world.
Right.
Of course, it's vertical, not horizontal, but the screen is just, you look forward and all you see is a screen. It's the kind of thing where I hate it and I love it at the same time. It's incredibly innovative, but I don't ever want to see it on my aircraft. It's just, I can't imagine how bright that aircraft must be on an overnight flight.
Must be kind of distracting. I mean, if you look forward, you'd see nothing but motion, you know, in front of you, because you'd have basically wall-to-wall screens as you look forward in the three-seat row, I would imagine.
And you know what? We're not that far from that right now. If you look at some of the newer aircraft that are going to, let's say, Emirates on their A380, the screens in economy are just teetering on almost too big. Mm-hmm. They look like tablets, basically, that they've just embedded in the seat in front of you. And Talos, fortunately, was pretty creative about the way they did this, that the top half of the long screen was the movie, and the bottom half, you could have your moving map, or you could have a drink ordering selection, or there's really a lot of opportunity that they can bring with that screen. But like I said, I love the possibilities, but I hope I don't ever actually see that in an aircraft.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
Kind of ranks up there with cell phone calls, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Jason, these are some of the things you look at in your day job, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. So in my my other life, my day job, I'm the data research manager at Root Happy, and we track exactly this, the passenger experience, the amenities you'll get on board from, are you going to get streaming Wi-Fi or streaming entertainment? Are you going to have Wi-Fi? Is it going to be live TV in the seatback system? Are you going to have a power outlet to actually charge your iPad so you can actually use the streaming entertainment? Is the seat going to be comfortable? So yeah, spotting new trends and developments like this is somehow become my day job.
They're trying to make the airlines great again, huh?
Yeah, let's not go there.
So what you have at Route Happy, and we talked about this, you know, previously, but it's been a long time. You have a kind of a scoring system, don't you, for airlines?
Yeah, so not so much for airlines, but for individual flights. All our rankings are down to the flight and cabin level. So you can go to our site or one of our partners like Google, Expedia, or Kayak, and you can plug in a route, let's say JFK to LAX, and we'll tell you exactly what's on board every aircraft, and we'll give you an actual ranking for that flight from 1 to 10. And basically, you can make an informed decision on what is on board that aircraft, so you don't have to get there at that moment at the boarding gate and wonder, is my flight going to have Wi-Fi so I can send that email, or is it going to have fresh food, or should I buy it before I board? Or we've kind of taken all the hard work of figuring out what's on board all those aircraft for everyone.
And is a 10, is that like live entertainment? Or what, what gets you a 10?
So there are a few flights out there. There are a few flights in business class or first class that do have a perfect 10. Those are very few and far between, though.
And those must be the 21-inch displays we were just talking about.
Yeah, it's really interesting what airlines are doing in the premium cabins. And now we're starting to almost see a trickle-down effect with premium economy. But there's a lot of diversity out there, and everyone should be making an informed decision before they click the purchase button on their next flight.
Do you see much of a correlation between what you call the happiest flights and the cheapest flights? In other words, if you pay more, do you usually get a happier flight with more in-flight entertainment?
No, actually. The airline pricing is very weird. Airlines don't price by the amenities you get on board for the most part. Everything's so dynamic, and what you have actually described is a feature of our site called the happy and cheap flight. So we will find you the best experience for the least amount of money. And it's surprising how often two identical flight times on airline A and airline B will be the same exact price, but the amenities and offerings on one flight will be so vastly superior that I almost feel bad for anyone picking the other flight.
Hey, Jason, this is really interesting. I'm going over to England for the air show at Farnborough. And so I typed in, you know, Los Angeles Heathrow. And I am shocked to see United with a ranking of 8.2. They're at the top of the list. I'm befuddled. How did that happen?
That surprises you, Brian?
That no one was higher than them? Yes.
Are they flying the 787-9 on that route these days?
No, this shows a 777.
777. Well, there's the reason, I assume. It's actually a very nice aircraft. Most of United's international fleet is actually quite nice. It's nine abreast 777, meaning they don't squeeze an extra human being in every single row. So that's actually become quite rare. They have on-demand free entertainment. They have a plug-in USB port at every seat. They have better Wi-Fi than most airlines. It's actually almost as perfect as you can get as far as the hard product can be on a 777.
Brian is speechless. Yeah. He's like, United? Good?
Okay. I just want to throw one thing in. I'm kind of a creature of habit because I fly Southwest a lot. I don't really, you know, we don't fly terribly long legs. I mean, but the thing that I noticed about them is that, you know, they're consistent. I mean, I measured the distance between where my knees were and where the back of the seat in front of me was, even when it was pushed back. And it was extremely comfortable. I think I would have liked it to be just a little bit wider. But be that as it may, you know, we don't have to cope with all the in-flight entertainment things. But my point was going to be, I wondered if anybody else had seen this new round of ads that Southwest has been running about transparency and they made a point that I've never heard them be so aggressive in saying, we don't try to trick you with new ways to charge you extra fees. And I thought, whoa, I just never heard Southwest be so pokey before, because usually the airlines don't go after that kind of stuff. At least I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, they've kind of been they've changed their tune a bit after their rebranding. And it's not like they're an airline that doesn't offer amenities. Almost every Southwest aircraft offers streaming entertainment, free live streaming TV, and even Wi-Fi. So it's not like they're lacking amenities. And
well,
like
that's true. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Their seats are plenty comfortable, but they've definitely taken a more aggressive marketing stance recently, and I actually kind of like that.
Well, so do I. I just thought it was kind of cool. But anyway, so all right, had to throw that in there after the Apple Crate content.
Jason, you were talking about the 777 and how nice that is, at least in the United version. But I do note that you were on a China Eastern 777 recently for a trip, and you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I definitely had some thoughts on that. So recently I flew New York to Japan via Shanghai with China Eastern. It was a ridiculously low fare that I just really couldn't resist. So I just booked it and went. And they were gracious enough to upgrade me to business class on the way out to Shanghai so I could experience their new product. It's relatively new aircraft for them within the last year or two. And I don't think many people have really had the opportunity to experience their new products and services. And it was eye-opening and an interesting experience from start to finish on China Eastern.
So when you say eye-opening, we're talking in a good way?
Yes and no. So the product itself, if you were to de-brand everything, if you were to strip the China Eastern titles and just put a human being on board that aircraft, you wouldn't be able to know what airline that is. You would think this is a top-tier airline. It has all the amenities. It has full-flat private seats up front. It's got power outlets at every seat. It's got these large entertainment screens. It's a top-of-the-line aircraft. There's no denying that. It's great. Problem comes with that things don't always work the way they should in China, that the entertainment system, although it's a great system from Panasonic, they didn't really know how to use it, and it wasn't loaded all that well. Let's say if I'm watching a movie, anytime the PA system came on for an announcement or the seatbelt sign was switched on, the entertainment system would reset and kick you out to the main menu. So you'd have to go through the kind of crudely translated menus to find your movie and then slowly fast forward to where you are. And on a 15-hour flight, that kind of gets old really quickly. Or in business class, they print out one menu for the entire year. And each month has a different color corresponding to a page on that menu, which is just absolutely bizarre. I've never heard of anything like that. If they're constantly reprinting these menus because they're getting dirty, I'm sure they're getting food all over them at some point. Why wouldn't you just print that one month or that one week for that flight?
Interesting. Yeah.
The headsets they gave out in business class were just the junkiest things I've ever seen. So it's weird things that you wouldn't expect, like you have to bring your own headset. And it was just a very strange experience that if they just make some minor improvements, if let's say a Western airline were to help them along a bit, they would be a fierce competitor. And it's interesting because Delta took a rather small chunk out of China Eastern, like a 5% stake in the airline. And Ed Bastian at Delta Media Day was actually touting China Eastern and Shanghai as becoming the go-to transfer point for not just China, but all of Asia. And he actually made some of the same points I do, that they're a little rough around the edges. But with some training and refinement, China Eastern is probably going to become a major global player.
Interesting. So it sounds like kind of with a few tweaks and attention to a few details that they could be pretty fierce.
Yeah, it's the attention to detail that really matters, especially in the premium cabins, that you can have the nicest car in the world, but if you put a terrible coat of paint on it and you just don't know how to operate the machine, it's not even worth it to have the machine. You have to try to make it a good product, and I believe they want to. They just actually have to go and do it. Someone has to teach them how to be a premier airline.
Very good. It sounds like a job for a consultant, a passenger experience consultant. Hey, Jason?
Yeah, I should think about that.
What an idea. Yeah. All right, well, good. Jason, tell us all where we can find more Jason Rabinowitz online. Where should we go look for you?
You can find me tweeting probably every 45 seconds these days on Twitter at Airline Flyer. You can find me writing for Mary Kirby's Runway Girl Network. You can find me on airlinereporter.com, NYC Aviation, Airways News. I'm a contributor to Forbes. Really, you have to try to miss me these days, I guess. But those are the main places you can.
That's a good problem to have.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
So you're having fun along the way.
Absolutely. Wouldn't be doing it if I wasn't having fun, and I'm having a ton of fun along the way.
I bet. All right. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
All right. Next up, a little update on what's going on in the lives of the airplane geeks here. We'll start with Rob Mark. What's interesting in your life these days?
Oh, well, heck, it's been a fun couple of weeks. Got to do a really fun NPR segment in Chicago here this morning. They invited me down for a segment they called The Working Shift. And they said, would you tell our listeners what it's like to be a professional pilot? And we'll just have them call in and ask any kind of question. I went,
yeah,
sure. So for about almost half an hour, it was a lot of fun. Got a lot of good, questions from folks about all kinds of things that you would imagine the public would answer. Like, what happens when it's bumpy? What are the pilots doing up in front when it gets bumpy in the back? And I said, oh, nothing. We're just, sitting. No. But anyway, so that was a lot of fun. But also a few weeks ago, I had a chance, a nice invite from the Embraer folks to go fly their Legacy 450 business jet down in Melbourne, Florida. And that was really an incredible machine. And it's, of course, as all of them are, completely automated, but flying with a side stick like a Cirrus. But what an incredible airplane it was. I really enjoyed it. And that story is coming out for Flying Magazine pretty soon.
Oh, cool. Can you give us a little preview of maybe one or two things that made it such an enjoyable plane to fly for you?
Well, I'll tell you the way the morning started out when I got to the airport, I wasn't so sure it was going to work well at all because I got to the airport and I was pulling up along the east side of Melbourne Airport, which is where the end of one of the runways is. And just out of the corner of my eye, I see the Legacy 450 coming in and I look and it's about 200 feet off the ground, landing gear up, going like a bat out of hell. And I thought, oh my God, this ain't going to be pretty. And then I looked as he went by and I realized he was doing a low approach for some camera work. So it was a lot of fun to get that thing going. But I was absolutely surprised at the incredible simplicity of the cockpit these days, which, of course, this is relatively new. It was just certified last summer, and the entire airplane is built like that. It's built as if everybody had all their ideas put together before the designers went to work and said, okay, so you want a lavatory this wide, huh? Okay, and you want it with windows on that side and that side, and you want this, and you want to be able to get to the baggage, and you want... And I think the best part, though, was that we went up to the service ceiling that day, which was 43,000 feet, and put it in long-range cruise. And honest to goodness, it was so quiet in the back. I stood against the rear bulkhead where in the lavatory, and I spoke to a guy who was standing up by the cockpit, which had to be... it's got to be 15 feet, I would think, at least. And we were just talking like this, having a good old conversation. And I thought, whoa, they have done such an incredible job with the thing that drives people crazy the most, which is the noise, especially on a long trip. And if the airlines ever get this far, oh, my heavens, is that something to shoot for? Again, the electronics, Rockwell Collins Proline Fusion, miracle machines as far as I could tell. They almost thought a few seconds ahead of me every time I wanted to do something. So there wasn't much for me to really do except watch the airplane show me how well it flew.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah, good. Max Trescott, what's going on in your world?
Well, this is like a soap opera, As the World Turns or something like that. Sure. So I'm still recovering in a good way from the huge safety event that we held Thursday at Moffett Field. So we had a huge turnout. 270 folks showed up, and I spent some time the day before with the Deputy FAA Administrator Mike Whitaker, showed him around Palo Alto Airport, and went for a visit to the tower. We were supposed to take a flight together. He's a relatively new private pilot, about 100 hours. We were going to take a Cirrus flight around the bay, San Francisco Bay, but winds were gusting to 31, and we just thought, you know, it's going to be bumpy, and it's not going to be not that much fun, so we didn't go. But Mike was our keynote speaker at the event. A couple of interesting things he said. He said that in 2013, when he was nominated by or selected by President Obama to be the deputy FAA administrator, he went to meet with the administrator. And they said they talked for about 90 minutes about all the different things that they're doing. And they said there was no mention of the word drones at all back in 2013 as they were talking about all the different things, you know, they'd be doing at the FAA together. He said now, 3 years later, he spends most of his time working and thinking and talking about drones, which I thought was kind of interesting. Number two guy in the FAA is spending most of his time on drones. I mean, I wouldn't have thought that. Somebody asked him about the number of registrants and how many drones there are out there. He said they have about, I think he said 450,000 people have registered. And he said they don't really know how many drones each person has, but their best estimate is that each person has 1.5 drones and that each of those drones on average lasts for about 1.5 flights. Which cracked me up as a drone owner. I thought, yes, you are absolutely correct. You have this nailed. So that was pretty funny to hear him talk about that. He talked at length about the ADS-B, and he said that a lot of people are kind of slow to equip. They seem to think that, well, the FAA is going to give them an extension to that deadline. And he said, absolutely, that will not happen. He said that the part of the reason the airlines have agreed to go ahead and equip with ADS-B is that they've been assured that that deadline will stick. They don't want to spend millions and millions of dollars on something that gives them no additional benefit.
Sure.
And so, you know, they're pretty insistent that if they're going to spend all this money, then everybody else better indeed stick to the deadline. So, you know, I think the concern right now is people need to start booking time in the radio shops because there's just not going to be enough time to, you know, get all of these aircraft, 200,000 GA aircraft equipped with the ADS-B if everybody waits till, you know, 2019 to do that. Deadline, of course, is January 1, 2020. So all in all, a great event at Moffett Field. And it, by the way, the Solar Impulse had landed a few days earlier. So I connected that team with the administrator, and they set up an appointment with him to come by, and he actually got to sit in it.
Very nice. The
solo seat in the cockpit. So I think that was the highlight of his trip out here. So it was great to hosting him, and you know, I can assure you we've got some really great people you know, working at the top levels in the FAA administration. Interestingly, when we spent all the time at Palo Alto, he had a lot of questions about you know, what the FAA can do from a policy standpoint to help the growth in the GA industry. So this is a pet topic of his, and it was very gratifying to see that you know, a number two guy at the agency really cares about GA and wants to help it grow. So it was a fun week, kind of exhausting, and like I said, still recovering here, but it was well worth it.
All right. And Brian, we know that you're just back from Germany, but you've got some other exciting things to talk about.
Yeah, I'm definitely keeping up my part of being busy, or keeping that show theme going. So yeah, went out to Germany for a quick trip, flew on United out and back, and what a difference. Flew on 767 in each direction. One of them was newly refurbished, and the other one, not so much. And I would have thought I was flying on two different airlines. On the way back, the plane was just beaten up and looked like it was a week late for its date at the spa to get refurbished. So it's really amazing what a difference a refurbishment can make. Then I was out at Chino at the Planes of Fame. So I get off the airplane and head over to the air show. And oh my gosh, if you are a World War II junkie for airplanes, this is the place to be. I have never seen so many Mustangs flying at the same time and on static display. They had five P-40s, which is one of my most favorite aircraft. They had a Zero that had just come off the refurbishment line, and it had only flown the day before. So seeing that in the air was great. And the list goes on and on and on. I have five pages of notes that I'm not going to read right now. I'll type them all up, and hopefully we can put them in the show notes somewhere. And just wanted to give a shout out to Chris of Planes of Fame. He actually took me behind the scenes in a little golf cart, and we went riding around, and I got to see some of the aircraft that wasn't on static display. That was really cool. One of them was David's Northrop Flying Wing. Unfortunately, the starter was broken, and they couldn't get it going that day because that was supposed to fly in the air show. But I actually got my photo taken with the aircraft, so I'm going to send that over to David. Figured he'd be nice and jealous over that.
Yeah, for sure.
And then besides all the other really cool stuff that happened, you know, all the vintage aircraft, the aerobatic stuff, Dennis Sanders did a fantastic job. Sean D. Tucker was there, did an amazing job as always. To me, the highlight of the show was they had a F-16, which was so incredibly loud and just such a high performance aircraft, and watching that fly. But they closed the show, or one of the last segments of the show. I actually had to leave at that point, so it was a close for me. They did a flight with the F-16 and three P-40s, and it was just fantastic to see them do a few laps around the show circuit, and it was really, really special. And they did a missing man formation, and it was just such a great event. Those guys definitely know how to put on an air show. It was so much fun, and I'm so happy and honored that I was able to participate in it.
And you sent along a recording of the P-40 and F-16, and maybe we'll close out the show at the end with those sounds. Nothing like the sounds of great aviation engines.
Yeah, one of the other things that I really have to give a lot of props to David. We've listened over the years to some of his recordings that he's done of interviews at air shows like this, and I decided to throw my hat in the ring to do some recording. A, it's phenomenally difficult to get people, and when you get people, finding a place that's quiet, that, you know, coming up with the questions to ask them on the fly, it's really difficult. So, yeah, David, hats off to you for doing this. I have a recording of the interview that I did with the folks from March Air Reserve Base, and they're just so great. So I'm not sure when you want to run that, but it's a great little interview, I think.
Yeah, these are the two C-17 pilots, and I think let's listen to that right now.
This is Brian Coleman, associate producer of Airplane Geeks, and I am here at the Chino Planes of Fame Air Show. I am fortunate enough to be with not one, but two majors for the C-17A Globemaster III. And I have Major Frantal and Major Condor. So thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure.
Oh, you're very, very welcome.
Many people want to know, what is the common mission of the C-17?
Really, the primary mission of the C-17 is cargo transport and, you know, troop transport. We can do anything. It's the old adage of you call, we haul. And we've all taken stuff, anything from trucks to trailers to tanks to pallets of weird cargo to, I've actually taken pallets of Charmin toilet paper one time before. So you get anything. It's literally anybody in the military, even our allies, can call. The old adage, like I said, is you call, we haul.
And Major Frantal, being a woman in the Air Force, any particular challenges that you faced in getting to this rank, and how do you enjoy flying?
Well, being a female, obviously there's been several females ahead of me that have already paved the way, so I appreciate everything they've done, particularly the WASPs. If people are familiar with the WASPs, they flew in World War II, so it's an honor for me to follow in their footsteps. It's an honor for me to fly in the Air Force. No extra challenges. I mean, it's a challenge just being in the Air Force for all of us. They don't treat me any different, and I appreciate that, and it's an honor to fly for the Air Force. As far as missions, I love all the missions that we do. It's an honor to be able to serve my country and take people and troops and cargo around the world and get things done.
So we're standing here in the cargo department. It's some seats going down each of the sides of the aircraft, an awful lot of tie downs. So besides typical crates or tanks or troop carriers, what else have you carried, or what's normal for you guys?
What's normal is usually we take a lot of cargo into theater. We do a lot of humanitarian relief, which is an incredible mission. For example, when Haiti had their earthquake, we brought in lots of earth-moving equipment, lots of search and rescue teams and dogs and other people to help with the rescue mission. Again, that's one of the great aspects of being in the Air Force, that we do the job that's multifunctional, and humanitarian relief is an incredible mission that we do serve.
So besides moving military assets, you're moving civilian assets, and like you said, humanitarian relief stuff as well.
Exactly, yes. We do a lot of humanitarian relief with, like I said, Haiti's earthquake. We did the Japan tsunami. We're always on call for any other kind of humanitarian relief that's going on around the world. And it's always a pleasure and an honor to be able to serve in those capacities.
Although we didn't get used for it this time, we actually were on call for the Ecuador earthquake and also for the earthquake recently happened in southern Japan. They didn't actually end up tapping us for this one, but we were on call for that one as well.
And where are you guys based out of? I forgot to ask that at the beginning.
No, we're actually based in Southern California, right over in Riverside at March Air Reserve Base.
Okay.
But and just one more thing to throw in, but you're talking about the different cargo and stuff that we do. One of our primary missions that we do quite a bit is the medevac, And we do we don't have that set up down here right now, but we'll actually set up litter stanchions all the way down the cargo compartment and all the way back up to where we can carry, 35, 36 different litter stanchions of wounded soldiers from inter-theater and bring them out of theater, bring them to Walter Reed, Longstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany. But we'll actually be able to configure the whole cargo compartment like a flying ambulance, for lack of a better term, with doctors and nurses and everything down here. That's another kind of unique aspect that this airplane allows us to do.
Yeah, so it really has multiple capabilities and serves multiple functions.
Absolutely.
All right, is there anything else that you'd like to tell me about the aircraft?
It's an impressive aircraft. As we mentioned before, it's multifunctional. We can do airdrop, aerial refueling. We can take on lots of different kinds of cargo loads. As Major Condor mentioned, we can convert it into an ambulance in the back, and we do so many different missions. It's an honor to be able to fly this airplane. This airplane is so well designed. It's incredible what it can do. We can do short field takeoff and landings. We can do any kind of airfield landing strip. So if there's a dirt strip out in the middle of nowhere, we're able to be able to land this incredibly huge airplane into that field. So this airplane is an incredible asset to the Air Force.
There's just the thing that's just the coolest to me, the whole 10, 12 years that I've been in the Air Force flying, is being up at 25,000 feet, like Mitch Frontal said, having a dirt landing strip, 25 miles away from you. And for those of you guys that have seen large airplanes and have been around large airplanes, just knowing that at an upper altitude, that if we want to get down fast, we're one of the few airplanes that can actually deploy the thrust reversers in flight. And the most that I've ever seen, and you can't sustain it that much, but you get a little bit slower and throw thrust reversers out and dive for it, is about 18 to 20,000 foot per minute descent rate. You talk about a rock in the sky falling down. Yeah, wow. So just throw that out there and just start diving for the ground, throw the thrust reversers out, and then land in a tactical location. And it's an absolute, like I said, an honor, but a blast to fly. And just hands off to the people, McDonnell Douglas and Boeing, that just designed and built this airplane. That's actually one of the really cool things that coming to an air show like this, that the people that we've gotten to meet today, the people that come up, say stuff of like, oh my gosh, I helped build the aft section of this department of the aircraft. I helped work on the wing route. I helped work on some of the avionics. And you get to meet the people that actually helped design and build the airplane from the 80s all the way up through the 2000s. And we tell them the capabilities that we do. And they're like, oh my gosh, you do that with this airplane? I'm like, yeah, you built it good enough. So just getting to see that kind of stuff is just, it's just such a pleasure to come out and just talk to people out here at the air show and share with what we do.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the unique things about being here in Southern California and the history of aviation. Well, Majors, if I can call you Majors. Majors, thank you so much for your service. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Brian, there's only one thing that you didn't ask them.
Uh-oh.
And that was about those four Pratt & Whitney engines on each one of those C-17s.
I don't know. Being able to deploy the thrust reversers mid-flight, come on.
Yeah.
That's...
Did he say 20,000 feet per minute descent? That's insane.
Yeah, what a ride.
He was quite proud of that. Yeah.
And the limit is the ear change. I mean, your ears must be exploding. I can't imagine the pressurization of the aircraft can keep up with that kind of change.
Wow. And aircraft that size, I'm having trouble even just imagining that. It's like a roller coaster ride. I want to go for a ride on that.
Yes.
Yeah, these two were so much fun to talk with. We probably talked for 20, 30 minutes before and after the actual interview, and I pieced together that interview. I guess it didn't sound so bad after all. I'll pat myself on the back for that, but gosh, yeah.
Yeah, nice job. Nice.
That was great. That was a really good interview.
It's all because of the talent. It certainly wasn't because of me. So,
okay.
Yeah. No, they were so much fun and just so happy to be there. And gosh, the Loadmasters, I swear, this one guy was 16 years old and he says that he wasn't, but they all look so young. I guess that's just a sign that I'm getting old myself.
I guess. Well, one last thing for you, Brian. Tell us about the John Mollison prints.
Oh, yeah. Also, before I went off to Germany, I sent them off to get framed and I got them back and I think they look great. The company I brought them to that had them matted did a fantastic job, and they're sitting up in my office right now. So I have the two prints proudly on display. So
you've got a B-17.
Yep, and again, my other favorite, the Corsair, and there were a bunch of Corsairs flying out in Chino as well.
Yeah.
So can't remember if there are four or five of them that were there. So a bunch of them.
Yeah, we'll put some photos that Brian took of those two prints in the show notes. Take a look. John Mollison does some just wonderful stuff. It's just really impressive.
Yeah, I'll definitely have some stories to tell about those prints now.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, we mentioned the Solar Impulse tour Max Trescott did earlier. And I assume as we record this, I guess they were to have landed in Arizona near Phoenix. Is that right, Max T?
Sure. They left about 5 a.m. and I can't remember if they said it was 12 or 16 hours. You know, at 2 miles an hour, it takes a long time.
Yes.
17 hours from California to Phoenix. It's not a quick trip.
No.
And part of it is that traditionally they arrive early and then hang out in circle. You know, they want to get there after the winds die down. So most of their landings have been, you know, sunset or later. And I'm sure that's exactly what's going on here. We could look at their flight path. And my guess is it shows a few holding patterns in there.
And this leg was piloted by Andre Borschberg. If you visit solarimpulse.com, they have some great coverage, particularly their live coverage. So you can ride along with the Solar Impulse too. It's a great website. They've really done a lot of great things, I think, in terms of making the experience enjoyable, you know, remotely over the internet. So I think they should get a lot of credit for doing that. And again, that's at solarimpulse.com.
Yeah, definitely a site to check out.
Yes.
We should encourage any listeners in the Phoenix area to go visit. They're going to be at the Goodyear Airport, as I recall. No telling how long they're going to be, but it's definitely worth worth getting a chance to see this this spindly aircraft in person.
Right, right.
I can't wait to see them here in New York when they finally get to this coast.
That's right. I think that's the next stop, isn't it?
That's the last stop.
The last stop.
There's going to be at least one or two other intermediate points.
Oh, good. Yes, yes. Okay.
Yeah, I think they're stopping somewhere in the Midwest. I don't believe they have said where exactly yet,
yeah.
But a few more stops before they get to New York.
All right. An item or two of listener mail. We heard from Carter. Got a great email from Carter. Now, he's been flying the 737 for the last 32 years. Well, also a little bit of DC-10 and DC-9 along the way, but mostly 737s. And he wrote to us to say that the 737, you know, it really does need a refresh, let's say. So from the perspective of a 737 pilot, he gave us a list of what he thinks a new aircraft needs. He also notes that to a certain extent, Southwest kind of dictates to Boeing what the 737 looks like. But despite what Southwest may or may not like to see, these are the things that Carter would like to see. So we can just run through this list really quickly. The first one is carbon nanostructure. He says not just carbon fiber, but nanotubes infused into the carbon fiber or into the carbon weave. Gives it increases the lightness. It's stronger, electrically conductive, and it also prevents cracks from propagating. Composites there. Jason, in your work, does the general flying public have any opinions about composite airplanes? Do they know? Do they care?
Not so much composite, no, but it's the fringe benefits that come with composites, like the higher cabin pressure, the higher humidity, things that come along with the carbon fiber body are really quite an improvement. But the body of the aircraft itself, no, I don't think the flying public is too aware of that.
That's kind of what I assumed, yeah, yeah. Carter also talks about needing a new cockpit, something that's quiet, more aerodynamic, roomier, fewer parts, lighter, and so forth. He says, how about an AOA gauge, Boeing? Also, synthetic vision, and some other features of the cockpit. Rob, do these resonate with you?
Well, I think they do, especially just having gotten out of that legacy, because all the items we're talking about, a comfy cockpit, synthetic vision, I mean, that's all standard on a new business airplane these days. And I think the airline guys are, they're feeling the burn. They wish they had some of those cool toys, but they are really nice. I mean, when you get used to flying an airplane with – with synthetic vision, and it's IFR, and you look down and you can see basically what's going on around you. It just brings an entirely new dimension to flying.
Carter also talks about the wing. He says it needs a more aerodynamic wing with lower landing and approach speeds, something larger like a 757. Rob, how does or Max T talk about approach speeds? How does that impact the pilot's job of flying, landing the plane?
Well, usually faster approach speeds are going to require longer runways. So I don't know if he's saying he'd like a bigger wing so he could slow down and have more room when he lands at midway, for example. I mean, Rob, wouldn't that be the classic place where you'd really like to come in slower so you don't get that close to the end of the runway?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one thing I notice whenever we land at midway is that they seem to have the auto brakes set on high. And as soon as those mains touch down and the nose wheel comes down, wham, you're holding on to the seat in front of you because they want to get that baby down and stopped.
Yeah, I think Burbank's another candidate for that.
If he wants a low approach speed, maybe he should hook up with Solar Impulse. That thing probably approaches at like 5 knots. It's perfect.
Well, or if less. He checked out Solo, he can do that.
Yeah. How do you know when it landed?
Yeah, that's slow, right? Carter also mentions the brakes. He doesn't like the 737, particularly the 900 brakes. He says they're not very good. He likes the 757-200 brakes. He thinks Boeing could have done much better there. When I was out at Aviation Geek Fest, I actually had an opportunity to look at a Boeing brake assembly, I guess you'd say. And I assume this was for the 787. Considering where I was at the time, but I wouldn't know the difference. And it's just a massive piece of equipment, nothing at all, obviously, like you would expect to see in an automobile or something like that. But Carter thinks that needs better brakes. Also, a fly-by-wire flight control system. He says, about time, don't you think? He adds that to his list. Engines give us some choices. I'm not going to read all of his comments on engines because... Oh, I just won't say that. Aerodynamics. Carter says, I could go on forever here, but let's start with being able to climb up to at least 41,000 feet right off the bat, and at 0.84 cruise would be nice. Cabin stuff. A really good entertainment system, Wi-Fi everywhere. Carter says, and for God's sake, let's let the flight attendants run the cabin temp. He says, why do they keep calling me to warm up the aft cabin? Speaking of cabin overhead bins, why can't passengers... Now, this is an idea. I like this idea, although there's some issues. But he says, why can't passengers load their stuff into the bins in the waiting area? That's right, he says, the waiting area. Then when the bins are full, they automatically travel to the aircraft. This way, getting all the passengers on board goes very fast because you don't have to look for overhead space for their bags. Same with getting off the plane. Less ground time, faster turnaround, etc. I think we're due for some seriously innovative thoughts on luggage, either carry-on or checked luggage. I don't know. Jason, what are you thinking on that?
Me again, they want to load the bags into the bins before the passengers board.
Yeah, and then put the bins in the airplane.
About the bins that are going under the belly, not the overheads.
No, they're talking about overhead bins. Yeah.
How would that work exactly?
Well, just think about it.
You get three passengers together, you carry the bin. No, I'm kidding. Obviously, that's not what they have.
Imagine a bin is like a big long tube of bins or something, and that tube gets loaded in the waiting area, and then that tube gets inserted into the airplane. This is not something you could do with existing aircraft, obviously. No. But
Like the pneumatic tubes that you'd see at banks,
Costco. I was thinking the same thing. Well, just blow the luggage into the aircraft.
Isn't exactly the practical idea, but there is actually a lot of innovation happening with overhead bins. Both Boeing and Airbus, and really every aircraft manufacturer, is really rethinking how the overhead bins work to cram as many suitcases as you can in the overhead bins. And I mean, I don't think they're going to go as far as to load them in the airport concourse and then somehow get them on board, but this is actually a major sticking point for airline. Delta last year went as far as having employees actually preload the aircraft. They would come out to the gate hold area, take your suitcase and load it on board for you to speed up the boarding process.
We're missing a huge opportunity here. I think we need somebody like Uber to come along and you can just order up your clothes at your destination.
I think that actually exists.
You know, you rent 3 days worth of clothes and then you leave them there. You come back. why haul all this stuff around?
Do you think any of this will solve the problem of those people that are sometimes short in stature that wheel huge bags onto the airplane and then go, I can't lift it. Oh, gosh. I hope somebody helps me. I can't get this all the way up in that bin.
Stop packing rocks in your bag and it won't be so heavy.
Yeah, I've always thought that. Anyway.
How about the people that go into the overhead above you in flight and then drop stuff on top of you? I mean, I absolutely hate that.
Told you I was sorry, Max. Give me a break.
Oh, dear. All right. Carter had some other stuff for us, but sort of in the interest of time, we'll move on. Maybe we can come back to some of these ideas later. We want to thank Carter for sending this along. And actually, he sent a follow-up email, too, that contains some interesting stuff. So. Those of you listening have some thoughts, some ideas. What can we do in aviation that makes things, that would make things more enjoyable or more effective or efficient or whatever? You know, we'd love to hear some of the ideas. One last piece of listener mail. This came from Mike in Wisconsin. He's been listening to the show for about 6 months. He says he's enjoying it very much. What he did is he sent a link to, this is kind of a map. This is about an area that was created at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport specifically for spotting, for plane watchers. He notes it's a great idea. I wish more airports would adopt this kind of thing. I agree. So we'll put a link to this in the show notes, this map of the viewing area. And it, I don't know. It's like right in the, basically in the middle of the action. I mean, this is, this is taking sort of the spotting interests to heart.
Good for MSP. I know in one of their terminals, they actually have an observation deck, but I didn't know this existed. It's really, really good to see an airport taking initiative like this, especially in the United States where plane spotting is a little more frowned upon than in Europe or Asia. And as a plane spotter, I've had more than my fair share of run-ins with law authority and airport management. So this is great. Kudos to Minneapolis for coming through with this.
Yeah.
How does that typically go when, you know, they come up to you and they're not happy? I mean, you just have to leave?
It depends if we're talking about the airport's operations. They'll just shoo you off. Or in my case, if it's the Secret Service, they don't let you go too quickly. Or it depends who you're talking to.
Hmm. All right. Well, I think with that, we'll wrap up this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank all of you for listening, for sure. We have our 400th episode coming up next week. If you have some thoughts as you think about the past 400, 399 episodes of the Airplane Geeks, for as long as you've been listening, some moments that stick out in your head, send them to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and maybe we'll have an opportunity to read your significant remembrances from the podcast. We want to thank our guest, Jason Rabinowitz, aviation journalist, data research manager at Route Happy, and published almost everywhere else you find aviation content. Jason, thanks so much. Give us again some places where we can find you online.
Twitter at Airline Flyer. You can find me on Forbes, Airline Reporter, Runway Girl Network, Airways News, NYC Aviation, and everywhere in between. And thank you guys for so much for having me, and congratulations on almost hitting 400. That's huge.
Yeah, thank you.
We don't look a day over 300 either.
All right, let's tell our listeners where they can find us online, and we'll start with Rob Mark. Rob, where do folks find you?
Well, not as much on Twitter as Jason is. I mean, every time I flip that thing on there, he's got something going. I mean, I'm I'm trying to keep up with him, actually. So
I forgot to mention also on Snapchat, Instagram.
See, there you go. The guy won't stop.
Yeah, you got to stay connected.
Now, okay, just let me interrupt, Rob, just for Snapchat. Now, maybe I'm too old to understand what Snapchat is all about. How are you using that, Jason?
Okay, I'm also on the upper cusp of the age group for this, but I have been using Snapchat more and more when I travel. It's Twitter is more of a real time. You have to be there in real time to see what people are doing. But Snapchat, I use what's called the stories. Is you take photos, you edit the pictures, you send them to what's called your story. And they're good for 24 hours. Anyone who clicks on my story can see whatever I've posted in the last 24 hours. So what it's really good for is if I'm on a 12-hour different time zone. If I'm in Japan, people in New York 12 hours later can catch up when they wake up and basically just look through everything I've done without having to scroll through their entire Twitter timeline. It's actually quite a nice thing to have for someone that travels as much as I do.
May have to check that out.
Good luck.
Yeah, okay. All right, Rob, did you finish? I don't remember.
No, I was just thinking Snapchat sounds like going through my wife's purse when she's not looking. I don't know. Maybe I've got the wrong attitude. No, Jetwine, every place, Facebook, Twitter, the blog, who knows where, but type in Jetwine and you'll find us somewhere.
Great. And Brian Coleman, how do folks find you?
I am the anti-Jason.
You are, aren't you?
I really am.
Do we have to call your landline to get a hold of you?
Yeah. Practically.
So, Lucifer Coleman, where do we find you?
You can send him a fax, maybe.
No, get a piece of stone and a chisel and carve it out that way. No, the best only place to get a hold of me, especially now that I got my email back online, is at brian@airplanegeeks.com.
Okay. Maybe you will convert Brian one of these.
It's going to be a tough battle.
Max Trescott, where can folks find you?
Well, let's see. They can right now find me in front of the microphone here. But if they were looking online, all I can say is, you know, both Rob and Jason have more followers than I have on Twitter. So go on out to twitter.com, unfollow Rob, and go ahead and follow me.
Get caught up.
As long as you're not unfollowing me.
That's right. Now, you notice I left you in there.
Thank you.
Right. I didn't think that was the way it was supposed to work.
Oh, are you on this show? Because I've said this before, but only when you weren't on the show.
We're going to talk.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on Twitter sometimes as Max Flight. Also LinkedIn, the UAV Digest with David Vanderhoof every Friday morning, and with Mary Kirby on the PaxX podcast. You can also find some of us at the Airplane Geeks listener team. Learn more about that at airplanegeeks.com/team. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. You'll find links there to all the places you can find us on social media, not Snapchat, at least not yet, as well as how to contact us. There's also a donate button there if you'd like to help support the show financially. If you'd like to help Brian get to Farnborough, Brian, how can they do that?
Oh, I definitely appreciate a donation. You could go to airplanegeeks.com/Farnborough2016.
You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/399. Opening music is by Brother Love. I think we're going to be listening to Brian's P-40 and F-16 sounds as we fade away. And we'll ask that all of you please join us again next time as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And David usually says, and thanks for listening.